I thought I'd start with sort of a little preamble, really, about, I guess, how I've ended up talking about this particular issue, and how I sort of slid in, really, to by sort of coincidence rather than by design, to sort of researching around issues to do with the impacts of migration into the UK. My sort of subject area, sort of going back to my PhD, was around housing in particular, and sort of exploring the difficulties that different groups within society in the UK experience trying to negotiate a satisfactory sort of accommodation within the British housing system. And within that work, increasingly, and given that also one of the particular focus within that was around issues around race equality and housing, issues to do with refugees, asylum seekers and migrant workers were creeping into some of the studies that I was being asked to undertake. Quite diverse. I mean, for example, I was doing a piece of work about 5-6 years ago on minority ethnic housing experiences in North Lincolnshire, and if none of you know where that is, it's around Scunthorpe. Even there, issues around migrant workers and refugee housing were creeping into some of the work I was doing around housing challenges and problems. Similarly, work for Newcastle and Gateshead Housing Market Renewal Pathfinder, looking at housing experiences. Again, looking at the sort of problems and challenges within the housing system and some of the difficulties that particular households were facing accessing decent housing. Again, migrant populations, migrant workers and refugees and asylum seekers were coming into some of the analysis that we were undertaking. And so it kind of led me into thinking about the kind of issues from a housing point of view. But another sort of strand of work that I was engaged with is around the whole concept of community cohesion. And I did quite a lot of work around the concept. Originally arose in around 2001 following the disturbances in Burnley, Oldham and Bradford. And particularly the Kantar report identified housing as being one of the key factors underpinning what was perceived to be the sort of segregation of particular minority ethnic populations, particularly South Asian populations, in those towns, the segregation of those populations. And so I did quite a lot of work looking at community cohesion, sort of criticising and challenging it, as other people, Deborah obviously has done a lot of work on that. And what became more and more interesting is the way in which the cohesion agenda got wrapped up in the immigration agenda, in particularly political discourse. And I think that goes back right to 2001, when I think David Blunkett, I think the week before the Cantel report came out on the causes of the disturbances in the three Pennine towns, actually I think it was in the Independent Sunday, sort of headlined the fact that one of the fundamental issues was this notion of people integrating and signing up to notions of Britishness. This floated the idea of citizenship tests. And so although there was a whole range of different explanations given in the Kantar report for the disturbances, the one that the press picked up on, almost like sort of directed there by the then Secretary David Blunkett, was this issue of Britishness, citizenship tests, even though the people actually out on the streets in Bradford, Burnley and Oldham during the disturbances were second, third generation South Asian people as well as white British people. So that kind of work on cohesion increasingly led me into an interest in immigration, which was reinforced when, particularly post-2005 and the London bombings, the reorientation of the community cohesion agenda towards this notion, particular notion of integration. So it got very much bound up in the whole issue of immigration. I think another area that's been of personal interest is around the issue of social housing, and I'll talk a bit about this in the presentation, and the way in which that's been a particular sort of battleground around public and political discussion regarding the impacts of new migration to the UK. And it's very much an area where the BNP have centred a lot of their local campaigning in local elections around this notion that migrants, and often it's a bundling together of different groups, refugees, asylum seekers, migrant workers, etc., into this kind of overarching notion of the migrant or the immigrant, are sort of stealing a march on British citizens and gaining access to what is a scarce resource of social housing. And what sort of struck me about that issue, and I guess ended me up looking at these kinds of issues, is the gap between what the public and political debate seems to be suggesting and inferring, and what evidence is out there, and what the evidence is saying. and exploring that gap and trying to fill that gap, if you like. And recognising also when one looks for evidence, particularly around the issue of impacts, which has become a very divisive discussion around new immigration, when one looks for evidence, there isn't always a lot. There's quite a lot of evidence around the experiences of new immigrant groups, but in terms of how issues are playing out at the local level, how the arrival of relatively large number of migrants might be impacting in different ways in different kinds of places, there's not a lot of evidence to help us understand that. So that's really what led me, a rather lengthy incoherent preamble, I'm afraid, but that's kind of led me to where I am today, I guess, looking at this particular issue. So just to give you a sort of an overview of what I'm going to say, just say a little bit really, and I don't think with this audience I need to dwell on this particular point, but just to sort of flag up what I mean when I'm talking about the new migration and this idea of a relatively large scale migration that since the sort of mid-early 90s, which has been different and distinct perhaps to immigration streams that have gone before the UK. Reflecting a little bit on local impacts and maybe what we can draw from the existing evidence base. And I'm going to try and just sort of justify why I think it's important to think about place and neighbourhood effects when we're thinking about the consequences of new immigration. And then just to reflect a little bit on what is currently out there in terms of trying to explain local experiences and why local experiences of both the people who are arriving and the people who are living there in these places already vary and differ between places. And then finish off with sort of my ongoing efforts, if you like, to make sense and develop some kind of framework for understanding the way in which experiences and consequences of new migration are varying between places. So, start with new migration. I don't think there's any surprises here. I won't dwell on this too much, but just to sort of reiterate, when I'm talking about new migration, I'm talking about something which is perhaps distinct and different to what's gone before, pre-the 1990s. Large in scale, diverse in nature, a complex array of legal statuses that people are arriving into the UK under, and a very new geography of settlement, distinct and different, I think, to what's gone before. So just to reiterate a couple of those points and throw a few facts and figures just to make the point. In terms of numbers and the relatively large increase, 91 to 99, average annual net migration to the UK, 65,000. 2000 to 2009, 187,000, so quite a dramatic increase. 97 to 2010, estimated more than 6 million people migrated to the UK. So we're talking about relatively large numbers, unforeseen, not seen for quite a number of years. In terms of the diversity issue, I think it's a particularly important issue. Post-World War II immigration streams in the UK, diverse of course, but tended to be dominated by people arriving to the UK from particular locations, obvious examples being the Caribbean and the Indian subcontinent. And I think much greater diversity in the population arriving since the 1990s. If you look at the top 10 groups in terms of asylum seekers, say in the late 1990s and then maybe the mid 2000s, what you see is a very changeable profile, reflecting, I guess, the shifting geography of conflict and oppression around the globe. So increasing diversity in terms of countries of origin. And similarly, if you trace the sort of the top 10 countries of origin for people or migrant workers arriving into the UK, there's some kind of consistencies here, but there's also sort of countries creeping in and then disappearing out. So I'm suggesting there's greater diversity than might have been seen in previous immigration streams. And this is a map which just only captures one issue, which is it's national insurance registrations, which of course is required to work in the UK. It's taken from a report the Audit Commission produced. And this is, the darker the colour, the higher the number of national insurance registrations as a percentage of the working population. And I think what's striking on this map is you're seeing relatively dark areas in locations which perhaps haven't in recent history been used to accommodating diversity and difference as a result of migration. So a really good example, the obvious example of what people talk about is Boston and Lincolnshire, but you can see other areas in East Anglia, areas up in Cumbria, Lake District on the Welsh borders, often reflecting sort of agricultural work and work in the tourist and leisure industry. But a far more sort of diverse profile of settlement than was previously the case. And just to kind of reiterate that, a couple of facts from an ICOCO report. She's shown that areas which perhaps don't have a history of ethnic diversity, I've been seeing the arrival of migrants over the last sort of 10, 15, 20 years or so. I won't read those through. But just this point that the metropolitan centres in London, which perhaps were traditionally the destination point for people arriving, say, in the 1950s and 1960s, it's far more diverse and different, and people are venturing beyond London and South East. Of course, sound seeker dispersal is part of that process as well. In terms of impacts, well, of course, this has been an issue surrounded by controversy, and which I think is tapped into well-worn debates that everybody's familiar with, but it's captured the kind of public imagination in terms of it being an issue of significant concern. There's a couple of figures from an Ipsos Mori survey, an ongoing survey around issues that are causing people most worry and concern in the UK. In the mid-1990s, less than 5% identified immigration. By 2006, that was up to 44%. And it's kind of been roundabouts that, I haven't looked in the last year or two, but it's been roundabouts that by and large since then, I think. But what's fundamental, I think, to a lot of the discussion around impacts is this reliance on anecdote and presumption rather than evidence. Evidence very rarely seems to come into the political and popular debate around the impacts of new migration. But this notion that settled residents, often referred to as British citizens, are paying a heavy price for this new process of migration. Just to give you a flavour of this, I thought I'd sort of tap into an area where I've done quite a lot of work, which is social housing. Just a couple of slides to make this point around the kind of significance of sort of anecdote and presumption and these kind of well-worn supposed truisms around immigration sort of coming to light again. Housing originally was the sort of outer fringes a lot of the debate of the consequences of new immigration. Apart from if you sort of logged onto the Migration Watch website, where it was a constant theme actually, and if you read UKIP and BNP local election manifestos, housing was always there and was always a key issue within them. But in terms of the public and popular debate, on a sort of national scale, it rarely came up. It really, I think, until the kind of scale of A8 migration from Eastern Europe became apparent, and the whole series of concerns started to be voiced, particularly by service providers, about implications for community relations, and this notion that maybe sometimes British citizens were losing out in this kind of competition for scarce resources. And then, of course, we had Margaret Hodge, who wrote a piece in The Observer in 2007. And just to kind of summarise what she said, we prioritise the needs of an individual migrant family over the entitlement others feel they have. No evidence to back this up. It's a notion that she was asserting. Most new migrant families are economic migrants who choose to come and live and work here. If you choose to come to Britain, should you presume the right to access social housing? No, we don't know that they were presuming the right to access social housing. Neither did she provide any evidence that they were accessing social housing. But it captured the public imagination and it brought into the mainstream, I think, a series of kind of notions and debates which really have been at the outer fringes of the sort of BNP, UKIP and Migration Watch debate. And I think Trevor Phillips was right in sort of observing the allocation of social housing became one of the most frequently alleged injustices of immigration. What was interesting when one actually looked at the evidence, and there was a report to the Migration Impacts Forum, which quoted some work I did, some fairly basic work, where I looked at CORE, which, for those of you who aren't familiar with CORE attempts to monitor every new social letting made in England. And it provides a series of basic questions are asked of each new tenant when there's a tenancy group they're let by a housing association or a council. And one of the questions is nationality. Now, there's a number of kind of weaknesses with that data set, but if you just look at it, it gives you a sense of the profile of people in terms of nationality gaining access to social housing in England. And it wasn't sort of a groundbreaking piece of work, but in terms of the findings, it suggested that all Margaret Hodge needed to do was, before she wrote her Observer piece, was just log onto the CORE website and run a couple of very simple processing of some simple data to find that less than 5% of social lets in England in 2006-07 were to foreign nationals, and less than 1% were to accession state nationals, and that's the particular group she's focusing on in her comments. And I rather mischievously actually picked out Barking, and analysed Barking, because of course that's where that's where Margaret Hodge represents. And I think there's something like 5 lettings in Barking by housing associations to A8 nationals. Of course, this is going to change slightly since 1st of May with the end of the transitional arrangements. But you know, you see the point I'm making in terms of the public debate being out of kilter with the evidence. And there's been a couple of studies since which were commissioned. One by Charter Stewart Housing and one by IPPR looking at this, and no evidence being found. And the IPPR study, less than 2% of social housing in Britain is occupied by foreign-born people who arrived in the UK in the last 5 years. But the Mail, after this evidence came out, of course, says more than 1 million immigrants live in homes paid for by the taxpayer, taking no note of how long these people have actually been in the UK. They might be in the UK for the last 60 years. But kind of fanning the flames in the face of the evidence, continuing to fan the flames, and feeding to this kind of moral panic, if you like, around foreigners, pulling the wool over our eyes and benefiting from the overly generous nature of the British welfare state. But what does the evidence actually tell us when we actually go exploring the evidence? If that's the kind of moral panic and concerns that have been expressed in public and political discourse, what does the evidence actually tell us? Well, I mean, I'm skimming over quite a large evidence base here, but I think the thing that comes out of it for me is that, well, it's quite ambiguous and contradictory. I've made a few points here, some of them dealing with economic issues, some of them dealing with socioeconomic well-being of areas, some of them dealing with public services, some of them dealing with community relations tensions, also dealing with kind of issues around resource planning, which cropped up. And I think what comes out is that for every piece of evidence one can find that suggests there's a negative or problematic consequence, you can also find one that suggests there's been something very positive. And so it's an incredibly contradictory, ambiguous, a confusing picture that one can pull from the existing evidence base. And I guess what I want to argue is that one of the reasons for that ambiguity and that contradiction is that things vary from place to place. And the experiences of the migrants themselves, of the sort of settled residents in the areas where they're moving into, and the effects for those places vary from depending on where you look. There's different experiences and different outcomes in different places. And this needs to be recognised. And this reflects the importance of place as a determining feature of the experiences of migrants and of the places into which they're settling. So it's kind of inevitable that we're going to get ambiguous and contradictory findings around impacts and experiences, because impacts and experiences are going to vary from place to place. Problem, I'll come on to the problem in a minute. I think the main thing to say really is that in making this point, and I was picked up on this in some of the referee's comments when I was writing this paper, is that I'm not denying in saying this that differential packages of rights and opportunities associated with different legal statuses and immigration pathways are not important. Of course they are. Neither am I denying that migrants can prove resourceful and exercise agency, even within the most constrained of circumstances. But I'm just trying to assert that place as a social material setting and a meaningful location, kind of classic undergraduate kind of geography definition of place there for you, is important in determining the experiences and outcomes of immigrants arriving into the UK. So to fully appreciate these, we need to have some kind of reflection on the geographical notion of place. And then I argue that it's something that analysis has largely failed to acknowledge. And so I guess what I've tried to set out and do is set myself a challenge of providing some kind of framework that supports the exploring of the mechanisms through which place informs and is informed by new migration. So what I want to do with the rest of the talk is pick up on these 3 points at the bottom, reflect a little bit about the insights around the importance of place that we can currently pull from the evidence base, although there's not a lot. Reflect on sort of emerging attempts to explain local experiences and the importance of place and how far it takes us. And then finally finish off by reflecting on a framework that I'm working with and trying to take forward in terms of unpicking the importance of place to understanding local experiences and impacts. So in terms of insights from the evidence base, well, there's lots of common themes, I think, as I've already asserted out there, in terms of potential consequences. And the evidence base does speak to some of these. For example, around cohesion, around some notions of a burden being placed on public services, and also in sometimes this assertion that immigrants are losing out. Settled residents are losing out. But it's actually difficult to test those players when one looks at the evidence base, because most of the discussion around impacts is placeless. It's not rooted in a discussion of where these experiences and these impacts are playing out in the material and physical kind of situations in which they're playing out. A lot of the evidence that's out there about impacts is actually at the national level. This particular case for analysis around, say, labour market and economic impacts is at the national level. And it doesn't attend to local geographies of change. How is the impacts and experiences, say, to the economy playing out differently in Newcastle to London, for example? It's not discussed, it's not dealt with at a national level. On top of that, a lot of the analysis is kind of aspatial, and the work around housing is a good example of this. A lot of the discussion around housing it deals with the sector, deals with housing as a sector and as an issue. But it doesn't recognise that actually housing markets and housing systems are very variable across the country. And I mean, this is something I was often picked up on when I was presenting on some work we did around the housing pathways of new immigrants in Sheffield. And a lot of the people who've arrived either through the Gateway programme as refugees or arrived as asylum seekers and been granted leave to remain. In the Sheffield context, at that particular point in time, when they were granted leave to remain and approached the local authority as homeless, because they had 28 days to leave what was then NASA accommodation, were given a local authority tenancy because there was a surplus of council housing in Sheffield at that particular point in time. Whenever I presented this to anybody in London, it's a completely different scenario in London because demand massively outstrips social housing. Most of those people in the London context would be going into private rented accommodation. So immediately, the nature of the local housing market was seen as a precursor to the nature of the experiences that those immigrants were going to have in terms of their housing experience. A lot of discussion around impacts and focusing on particular sectors, education, housing, and such like, hasn't necessarily picked up on those nuances in terms of the differences between places. There's, of course, a massive evidence base around the experiences of different migrant groups, people coming through the asylum system, after they've been through that process, refugees, people granted leave to remain, there's also migrant workers. And often, I think it's fair to say that much of that evidence base doesn't sort of venture beyond describing those experiences and reflecting on the degree to which the social and physical environments within which these experiences are rooted inform the nature of those experiences. And also, I think, little attention to how new immigrants are understanding and negotiating the opportunity structures within different kinds of places, which do vary between places. So this is a curious failure, and I'm not quite sure for the reasons for it. It might be to do with the kind of disciplinary backgrounds of many of the researchers who are engaged in this kind of work. I think it also might be something to do with the fact that by merely considering the notion of impacts or consequences, one is I think there's a kind of maybe a discomfort within academic circles, because one is immediately engaging in a very kind of sensitive area, which has been dominated by public and political debate and discourse, which has been hugely kind of prejudiced towards and against migrant groups. I think it's possible to engage in a discussion around impacts and consequences without targeting the migrants themselves in the way that popular debate and discussion has done, and that's hopefully what I'm going to try and achieve. In terms of what we can pull from the evidence base around the importance of place, it's actually quite difficult, and there's a few fragmentary glimpses, and I'll just try and make a couple of points to evidence that place is important. And I think there's two things that really one can pull out. One is around the relationship between immigration and poverty and deprivation, and the other is around cohesion and new immigration. So just to make a few points around those, pulling from the existing evidence base, which I've said is fairly limited. I think the first thing to say is that recognising that people arriving into the UK will have very different experiences related to their legal status, the resources they possess and the opportunities to present themselves. By and large, the situation appears to be that people tend to end up living often in deprived neighbourhoods characterised by poor quality housing, high levels of unemployment, restricted service provision and limited local amenities. Those are residential situations which are likely to impact negatively and restrict in various ways the life chances of migrant households. And there's a rich evidence base talking about the importance of residential neighbourhoods in terms of informing life opportunities and well-being. And so I think that's an obvious link to make between place and the experiences of migrant households, the nature of the place in which they typically live. I think the other issue that can be made is the potential for migration to impact on places, to change the nature of places, and perhaps to raise some issues and challenges. An obvious one is that, particularly given the high levels of unemployment amongst refugee households and the relatively low income levels of migrant workers, is the potential for the arrival of migrant households into a neighbourhood to reinforce what might be existing geographies of deprivation and exclusion, intensify the nature of that social exclusion potentially, and also put a strain on services which might be already stretched and struggling, and particularly under the current programme of public sector cuts, which can result in tensions among parents and pupils. And I think you've got Mary Hickman coming to talk in a few weeks, and obviously her Joseph Rowntree study found some really interesting findings around that particular issue. I think the Glasgow case study in particular is worth looking out for that. And as Mary says in her report, that's perhaps not surprising given these kind of findings, that settled residents commonly perceive immigrants as unwanted outsiders, adding to the burden of deprivation and contributing nothing. But at the same time, it's possible to find evidence of the way in which the arrival of migrant households into particular places has had a positive effect. And there's just a few examples here. From our own work, my own work in Sheffield, which was a few, sort of 2007, so we did field work in 2006, the housing market context has changed since then. There's now waiting lists for social housing in Sheffield. But at that particular point in time, the asylum seekers who granted leave to remain were allocated to social housing, which other households had exercised an opportunity to leave, to abandon, or were choosing not to enter into. And these were neighbourhoods which were often suffering from problems of abandonment and low demand. And so they were filling voids in vacant properties, and it was seen as a positive opportunity in terms of promoting regeneration of those neighbourhoods, particularly given the stabilising effect that the arrival of these households often had in terms of turnover. And Pemberton, I think Pemberton in this paper talks about housing market renewal areas in the north of England, and the way in which I think Liverpool is one of the examples, and perhaps Newcastle. The arrival of particularly refugee households has stabilised areas of relatively high turnover. I'll talk a bit more about this later. Some Liberian refugees in Sheffield who arrived through the Gateway programme, so they arrived with refugee status and were supported for the first year, and they were placed in peripheral estates in the city. Historically, white British working class estates with quite a sort of inward-looking kind of notion of identity and self. And it encountered a whole series of difficulties, harassment being a major one. And we talked to a number of these people, but one of the stories that came out really strongly was this notion of hunkering down. Often these people had 10 or 15 years of kind of insecurity and uncertainty moving through refugee camps and such like. And we were talking to one particular woman, her saying, "I finally got home and I'm going to stick here and I'm not going to move and I'm going to put up with this and I'm going to lay down my roots because I can finally call a place a home and try and establish a kind of stable set of life." And that kind of sort of social cement also within the group, binding people to a place, which has often been characterised over the last sort of 10 years by high levels of turnover and sort of disruption. Another point which was talked about quite a lot in Mary Hickman's report is this idea of underpinning the viability of local services in these kinds of areas. Suddenly demand for those services, and school rolls is a classic example. Schools being at threat of closure because of low rolls, because of the areas being unpopular and relatively high levels of low demand and voids, suddenly having their rolls looking relatively healthy and the security of the school being secured. So it's a mixed picture. In terms of cohesion, quite a lot of evidence that raises the question around the potential for the sometimes rapid change driven by the arrival of migrant households into particular neighbourhoods to be seen as a disruption by the settled residents, and particularly to be seen as a challenge to notions of belonging. So this is, I'll come on to talk about one of the Sheffield areas, but it very much captured this, and Mayor Hickman Nirwell talks about a Glasgow neighbourhood, where there's a very kind of inward-looking notion of identity and belonging within the neighbourhood. And that's and often locations which don't have any history at all of dealing with diversity and difference in any form. That could be classes as well as nationality and ethnicity, struggling with the difference that the arrival of migrant households might force upon them. But at the same time, I think there's quite a lot of evidence to suggest that areas which have a longer history of diversity, particularly ethnic diversity, are much endowed with the capacity and capability to accommodate and perhaps gain advantage from the arrival of new immigrants. So the nature of the place, in this example I'm talking about, I guess, the nature of sort of collective identities and notions of belonging, is important in informing the way in which that place receives, interprets and responds to the arrival of the migrant households. Okay, so how do we explain, I hope I've kind of convinced to a degree, although it's difficult to do so because the evidence base is fairly limited, but that place is important. How do we start to explain the way in which place is informing these local experiences and try to analyse and understand that process? Well, the evidence base hints at some ways in which place might be important in determining local experiences of the impacts of migration. But I think there's a challenge which is actually difficult to unpick at the moment. I think Mary Hickman maybe in her report goes further than many and identifies aspects of the social and physical environment and collective cultures that she found were informing cohesion consequences in different ways in different locations. But what you find, even when you do come across these quite explicit recognitions of the importance of place, is that these observations are rarely followed up with any attempt to conceptualise and analyse the place-specific determinants of experiences and effects of new immigration. So when we were doing our work in Sheffield, we attempted to come up with some kind of notion or concept, try and help us understand the very different experiences that the different migrants that we talked to were having in different neighbourhoods within the city. And this is the idea of the contact zone. I was trying to remember on the train down how I ever came across this notion of the contact zone, because this reference to Pratt, 1991, I don't know much about her work, but she was writing in this particular book from a kind of cultural studies point of view about literature. And I don't know why I would ever have come across it, because I don't spend my time sort of flicking through kind of obscure cultural studies journals. I've got other things to do. But I came across it, and it just seemed to sort of fit and work in a kind of useful way. This idea of the contact zone. What Pratt refers to contact zones as being is social spaces where cultures meet, clash and grapple with each other, often in contexts of unbalanced power relations. And it just kind of seemed to ring with me as kind of a useful starting point for thinking about why the experiences of the migrants we talked to in Sheffield seem to be differing so much between the different neighbourhoods where they were living. And so what we tried to do is inject some kind of understanding of an appreciation of place into this notion that Pratt was working with. And we came up with I guess, two archetypes of place. The first is what we refer to as the established contact zone of immigration. So these are locations within, this is all based in Sheffield, but maybe rings true for other areas, locations of established minority ethnic settlement, which often had served as reception localities or move-on locations for previous immigration streams over many decades sometimes. So they had a kind of history of people from different backgrounds and cultures meeting, colliding, and negotiating some kind of social settlement, although often that could take many years. And so in the stories that people were telling us about their experiences in Sheffield, these were seen as places of greater safety and security. And what was striking, I'm going to show a map in a minute, I can point this out, was that the Liberian Somali and Somali refugees that we talked to, who were living out in peripheral estates, would often every day travel into these locations where they felt more comfortable and at ease. Often people were quite explicit to say, by virtue of not standing out just because they were not white, which was an issue on peripheral estates where they were living. But also another interesting fact that came out was that quite a lot of the Somali people we talked to had come in through the asylum route, and the NAS accommodation, what was then NAS accommodation, was in these locations. But then when the granted leave to remain, they were allocated housing in the peripheral estates. So they were returning to these on a day-to-day basis often. Often in these locations, there's kind of accumulated benefits of collective action. So an example for the Pakistani people we talked to, for example, was in one of these areas, there was a Muslim centre which they could go to for kind of support and information about how to access local services and such like. And there's just more of a cosmopolitan sort of nature, which kind of seemed to feed greater interaction. But that didn't mean there weren't problems around access to services and competition for resources. Just to flag this up, it's not the best map of Sheffield. I don't know if anybody knows Sheffield that well, you don't really need to. But one of the exercises we did with all the people we talked to, it was a qualitative study, so these weren't large numbers of people, but we did a sort of housing history from the moment they arrived in the UK for the first 5 years, or up to the first 5 years. The yellow dots are the Liberian respondents, and the green dots are the Somali respondents. Blue dots are Pakistani, and red dots are Polish. And what you find is that the blue and red are clustered. The red dots for Polish are in areas which have relatively large proportion of private rented accommodation and houses in multiple occupations. So that's kind of logical and to be expected. The blue dots for Pakistani respondents are clustered in areas where there's established Pakistani populations, because a lot of these people were coming in on spouse visas and entering into existing households. But a very different geography to the yellow and green. I'm going to come back to yellow and green in a minute. But just sort of reflecting on the Pakistani and the Polish experiences. So they were living in cosmopolitan landscapes around the city centres. These are diverse areas which had a long history of accommodating diversity and difference. They've often been the locations into which previous immigrants arriving into the city over the last sort of 30, 40 years had settled. And Pakistani people talked about this sort of invaluable advice and assistance that they got from family and friends, and also from community organisations that were present in those locations and were certainly not present in the peripheral locations where Somali and Liberian people were living. Polish people, interestingly, said that where they lived wasn't important, but they did end up living in typically the same areas. And then talked about the benefits of living close by to other Polish migrants, including help finding work and help finding accommodation. And interestingly, in these two locations, the people we spoke to talked positively about their relations with their white British neighbours and the ways that the Somali and Liberian respondents didn't in the very different neighbourhoods they were living in. Just to pick up a little bit, and by moving on to the second archetype in the Liberians and Somalis, in the Sheffield context, the second archetype around new contact zones, these are relatively stable white British working class neighbourhoods dominated by social housing. But you might say that other archetypes of this kind of place that raise some similar issues might be small towns or rural areas where obviously a lot of migrant workers have ended up. So they're characterised as having a limited recent history of minority ethnic settlement, and residents seem to be more likely to be uncomfortable with accommodating diversity and difference. Local provision often proved more insensitive to this emerging diversity. So service providers in those locations weren't necessarily used to working with diversity and difference and people from different backgrounds, and the nature and sensitivity of the services wasn't therefore accustomed to that and wasn't sort of picking up on the particular needs of Liberian Somali households. And in particular the Somali, what's interesting here to emphasise, of course, is Sheffield has a large and long-standing Somali population, going back at least to the 1950s, who came from ports where the Somali population historically lived in England to work in steel mills. So it's got a long-standing Somali population with a lot of Somali groups and a lot of Somali organisations, but not in these neighbourhoods. And so the Somali people were talking about sort of struggling as a consequence of that. And this idea of othering of difference is a key issue, particularly around ethnicity for these groups. And some quite harrowing stories of harassment amongst these respondents, and a number of people have actually moved out and abandoned the social tenancies altogether because they didn't want to continue living there. So these are the peripheral estates. part of the, you know, built as part of the slum clearance program in the city in the 50s and 60s, which at this time was suffering from low demand, had a lot of voids, hence the once granted leave to remain and approach the local authority that could be housed there as homeless. And just to sort of reiterate these experiences of these particular respondents and how very different they were to the Polish and Pakistani respondents who were living in different neighbourhoods. So not many stories of neighbourliness, not many stories of interaction and contact with the existing settled residents. They were largely absent from the stories that people told us. Talked about having very few friends nearby, little contact with neighbours, and a sense of isolation, which was often compounded by the corrosive impact of harassment. We got some quite extreme stories of harassment. And the alienating effect that had in terms of sense of belonging to the neighbourhood, sense of belonging to the city of Sheffield, and sense of belonging to the UK as well. And there's work being done in Glasgow by others who've picked up on that relationship. Okay, so that's the contact zone, and we found it useful, but I think we found it useful as an organising device, and not necessarily much more, and I'll say a little bit why. It kind of recognises that place is important, it recognises a material form, it contains physical resources, social relations, it's rich in meanings and values that can be contested and challenged, and it points to some of the ways in which geography matters for experiences and impacts of immigration, but it has its limitations. I think if you start imagining a neighbourhood that falls between those two archetypes that I've spelled out, you start struggling to know how this kind of concept of the context zone actually helps you. How does it begin to sort of unpick how places, the importance of place is playing out and informing the experiences of people if you're not in neighbourhoods that conform to those two archetypes? Just to make an example of this, and this is something somebody else picked up when reflecting on how I'd use the contact zone, and it's an absolutely valid point, is that how does the notion of the contact zone deal with this kind of conflict? So there's evidence suggesting that locations with a history of accommodating diversity and difference are often better equipped to manage challenges posed by immigration. Okay. There's also evidence to suggest that deprived neighbourhoods perhaps struggle more to accommodate migration and perhaps have more issues and difficulties. But many of these areas are deprived. So how does the kind of contact zone help, the concept of the contact zone help us unpick the interplay of these different variables? Well, it doesn't really. It's a descriptive rather than an analytical device. And it's useful as a descriptive device, but it doesn't really take us anywhere in terms of analytically understanding the interplay between experiences and the nature of the places in which people are living. So, the challenge is to try and move forward from that, and that's what we're going to try and finish off talking about. And this sort of brings me into sort of talking about place and reflecting on the nature of place and trying to learn from other work that's sought to explain and understand place effects, and particularly drawing on some work that's been used around understanding the way in which health and place interact, which I found particularly useful. So if we accept place as a location which has material form, constitutes and contains physical resources, social relationships, and is invested with meaning, it's also the everyday realm in which people act, in which opportunities and constraints are manifest and identities are forged, problematised, and sometimes, of course, clash and end up being reformed. And it also gives access to different packages of resources, services and facilities, housing, GPs, schools, etc. Different profile provision in different kinds of place. And in some places, the dominant culture and identity might be a source of safety and security and give a sense of belonging. For other people, it might isolate them and make them stand out as distinct and different. I think the challenge is to develop some kind of conceptual framework which helps explore the importance of all of those things on the experiences of immigrant households and also of settled residents. And the resulting variable geography of the impacts and experiences of migration. So I think a useful starting point is the work that's been done by McIntyre and also Steve Cummins, who I think are Glasgow, aren't they, I think they're based in Glasgow. But they've done an awful lot of work around trying to take forward understanding analysis of geographical variations in health and the degree to which where you live impacts on your health. And I found this sort of really, really useful for trying to understand how I can bring a sort of a conceptualization of place into my attempts to understand different experiences of migration. And they come up with a McIntyre originally and working with Cummins subsequently, they come up with a three-way categorization of different dimensions of place. Compositional explanations draw attention to the characteristics of the individuals living in particular places. I think often in attempts to understand place effects, the characters of the individual, what actually often is being talked about is the composition of the population. This is dealing with that issue. Who lives there? Who are the people who live there in terms of the existing residents and the incoming residents? The second is the nature of the context, and that's physically and socially. What's the nature of the context and associated opportunity structures within the local and social physical and social environment? And the third is the collective nature of place. And this links into notions around sociocultural and historical features of communities. And so I think it's possible to apply these three types of explanations for variations in local experiences and consequences of health to try and begin to try and unpick the importance of place and informing variations in local experiences and consequences of migration. And that's what I'll do sort of fairly swiftly. I'll just go through each of them and reflect a little bit on what I can take from thinking about these different dimensions and applying it to what I know and understand to be happening around migration. The compositional then is who lives there, and it captures the dimensions of place relating to the profile and characteristics of the local population. And I think in the context of migration, this is the established population and it's the newly arriving population. And I think key features might include the socioeconomic circumstances, so wealth, issues around disadvantage and deprivation, and the personal resources, financial and social. And that's of both new and settled residents, and that interaction is important. There's also some important issues around ethnic and cultural identities in terms of the composition of the population, but also the legal statuses associated with rights and opportunities of the migrants, and the size of the migrant population, I think, is an important compositional element to this. In terms of contextual, just a reminder here, we're dealing with the specifics of the local, social and physical environment. I think aspects of that we might reflect upon when thinking about the importance of context, material conditions, and I've talked about this quite a lot, the nature of the wealth, deprivation or disadvantage within a particular location, the availability of resources, the role and function of a place in the wider urban context. Is it a location that is familiar with and used to an ongoing process of turnover? Is it a neighbourhood that's seen as a kind of transitional neighbourhood and plays that role and function within the city? That might be reflected in the fact that it has a long-standing history as a place of a sort of arrival and settlement of new immigrant groups. It might be just that it's an area used to turbulence because it has a high student population and a lot of it has a multiple occupation. But that's an important kind of sort of aspect of the context, if you like, the role and function of the neighbourhood. Do opportunities exist for interaction? For example, there's a lot of work around the importance of third spaces, shops, parks, community centres and such like. It being an important opportunity for people to come into contact with each other and to have some kind of interaction, engagement. Do those exist? Sort of a lot of neighbourhoods, of course, have been sort of hollowed out in terms of that resource, and those opportunities might not exist. Others perhaps are richer in those resources. That partly links to the sort of strength maybe of the third sector or the community and voluntary sector within the location. What kind of social networks exist? What kind of support and assistance is available? Again, this might be reflective of the example I gave around Pakistani people in the Muslim centre in a particular neighbourhood that existed and provided support and assistance and advice for accessing services and did coffee mornings and such like. Do those facilities and services exist? What local opportunities are there for voice? What kind of representation do different groups have? And what kind of organisations and bodies exist in a location, in a place? Those are all important, I think, dimensions of context which might inform both the experiences of the migrants and the experience of the settled residents in a particular location. And then the collective, I think, captures the socio-cultural and historical dimension of place. And this relates to collective social function. And I've given a few examples, and I think I've probably covered most of this already. But this is the sort of history of norms and values associated with shared sort of identities that might exist in a particular location. And you can imagine how that is important. I'll give you some examples comparing the peripheral historically white British estate with the relatively cosmopolitan inner city neighbourhood in Sheffield. What kind of shared understandings and practices are there within the local population? What kind of contact and interaction has there been in the past and is there currently between different groups, people from different backgrounds? Are there recognised collectives and is there strong political representation of a particular group, which could be a positive or a negative in terms of the impacts upon a newly arriving group? What are the local media representations and associated discourses around migration? And are they sort of, how are they playing out in particular locations? So just a table which kind of summarises and tries to capture these different dimensions. The composition is around population attributes. I think in a lot of the analysis, there's a huge literature on place effects. I'm not getting into that too much at all. But I think there's often the approach to understanding place effects has been to try and look at the composition, who lives there, the profile of the individuals, try and explain all one can in terms of variations in experiences and outcomes, be it health or whatever, and then look and see if context explains any of the leftover. And I think the approach to this needs to actually step back from that, because of course the compositional and contextual are closely related, and they're also related to the collective, so they need to be seen as separate strands perhaps from the process of analysis and trying to pull out and understand, but actually they have to be viewed as sort of overlapping and interweaving. People make places and places make people. And that sort of brings me on to a few sort of final rules of engagement of how I'm trying to use this and take this forward. I presented these three dimensions of place as sort of separate, and that's really an unpicking of a knotted relationship for the purposes of exposing them and trying to take analysis forward. Of course, in reality, it's all very messy. They overlap, they're interlinked, and they're interrelated. And they only make concept when only make sense when the relational connectivity between them is acknowledged and sought to understand it. Like I've said, places make people and people make places. So it's important to avoid privileging any one of these dimensions over the other, but to explore the patterns and linkages between the contextual, the compositional, and the collective nature of places. So I think the general challenge, which I'm sort of beginning to try and look at myself, I've got a tiny AHRC grant as part of the Connected Communities Programme, and it's really a research review, but we're trying to sort of, in a more systematic way, it's not a systematic review, but in a more systematic way than I've done in the past, try and look through the broad evidence base and start pulling out what maybe we can put evidence and information we can pull out for the variation, the factors informing the variation in different outcomes in different places. And I think that's the challenge. Before we can start developing conceptual models relating the pathways through which place informs the experiences and outcomes of immigration, we need to start understanding what the outcomes are and perhaps what potential influencing or explanatory variables of those outcomes might be, and then start abstracting between those and trying to forge some kind of suggestions and models of what those relationships might be. That's difficult to do because there's not a lot of evidence at the moment. And I think the challenge is to sort of, for us all really, to start bringing a notion of place more into our work and trying to think through maybe how important is the compositional nature of the places in which these experiences are rooted? How important is the contextual nature of the places in which these experiences are rooted? How important is the collective? So to sum up, I think there's been an awful lot of furore around the issue of impacts and consequences of new immigration, but actually there's not much evidence out there, and what there is tends to be aspatial and tends to be placeless. So the result of this is there's a void in understanding of neighbourhood effects, and I think that's dangerous because the void's been filled often with prejudice and presumption. And I think the illustration of social housing shows that the degree in which things can take hold based on absolutely no evidence whatsoever and become really a dominant discourse informing both public response and political response to the issue. Migration can drive change at the local level, yes, but the consequences are far more complex and variegated than is acknowledged in public and political discourse. And I think there's a challenge to generate the evidence base to contest that and recognise and understand that variation. And that's really what I'm trying to do in my small way with by developing this framework and also trying to take this framework forward. And there's an appeal for anybody who's doing work around migration and the experiences of people arriving to the UK and the impact of consequences of their arrival for themselves and also for the settled population and the places in which they're living, to try and engage with geographical perspectives on place. And I think it certainly should help strengthen our understanding and analysis. It will also help me as well. In terms of the next steps, I think there's an interesting issue around actually mapping and profiling how experiences and outcomes vary between places. I don't think we have much of a good understanding about that issue in terms of experiences and outcomes of immigration. How are they varying from place to place? We don't really understand that geography. We can come up with examples. So I can talk about the housing market in Sheffield being a very different housing market in London, therefore has some, but it's pretty piecemeal. We don't really understand how this is playing out in different ways in different places, largely because most of the analysis that I've said is aspatial and tends to be places. I think we then need to try and start developing and try to substantiate some of the causal pathways through which place affects the experiences and consequences and start to test those maybe out in the field. So I think that's the end. Thanks very much indeed.